Hello and welcome to The Fix, a podcast about Photoshop, Lightroom, post-processing, and the cool and creative things we get to do with our images after the shoot. I'm your host, Sean Duggan, and on today's show, my guest is Carrie Bean, a professional retouching artist from New York City who specializes in digital retouching for fashion, beauty, and high-end product photography. We're going to take a look at some really cool examples of the type of retouching that Carrie is often hired to do, and she's also going to give us a peek behind the curtain and deconstruct one of her layered retouching files and show us some really cool and useful Photoshop tips for fashion and beauty retouching. Stay with us. Well, Carrie Bean, thanks so much for taking the time to join me on The Fix. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. It's my pleasure.
And you are based in New York City, which I imagine is a good place to be for the type of high-end retouching work that you specialize in.
Absolutely. I think this is the main place to be, at least in the United States. This is a good place to be, a good place to get started.
Yeah. And so, you know, on your website, which is carrienyc.com, it says that you specialize in digital photographic retouching for fashion, beauty, and high-end reproduction. And as we see some of the of your work on your website, kind of in a slideshow right now, obviously there's a lot of there's Rihanna.
Yeah.
Obviously, there's a lot of high-end beauty and fashion stuff, and so is that the bulk of the work that you do? Give us a rundown of the type of projects you tend to work on.
Yes, we do high-end, what we call high-end retouching. We do cosmetic, a lot of hair clients, a lot of not a lot of product, but we have a couple of high-end product clients that we do. It's nice change of pace from doing hair, which is very tedious, can be very tedious. It's more difficult retouching, but mainly beauty, cosmetic, fashion, hair, and product.
And then the end use of these, I'm guessing a lot of magazine reproduction.
Mainly magazines. They'll be for commercial advertising in magazines and billboards. And the Rihanna ad I saw go by on a New York City taxi the other day, which was fun.
Yeah.
I'm used to seeing my stuff in the magazines and in light boxes, in store imagery, but it's fun to see it go by on a taxi.
So when you say light boxes, you mean kind of like a Duratrans?
Exactly.
A backlit display.
Backlit display. They use an RGB image to create those. So, So they're like a backlit from light RGB image.
And so this is kind of a total diversionary question, but I'm going to ask it because I know if I don't ask it now, I'll forget about it. So like when you hand off final files to your client, are you handing off RGB or CMYK?
I give both. We used to work in CMYK all the time in high-end retouching studios. We worked that way because that was the output, because the stuff was all of it was for print. There wasn't as much, when I started, there wasn't as much stuff on the web as there is now. People didn't share the imagery as much, like even on Instagram. For example, when I did Rihanna's ad, as soon as I turned that ad over to her, she Instagrammed the image.
Hmm.
So, yeah. So these days we work in RGB, and then at the end, I create the final RGB TIFF, and then I make a CMYK conversion, and I give the client both.
Mm-hmm.
So there's two files. Every image gets two finals, RGB and CMYK.
Yeah, yeah. And so how did you get started in this fascinating realm of retouching?
Well, I was a painter. I studied painting. I went to the Kansas City Art Institute, and I was cruising through life doing a variety of other things when I needed to, like, reinvent myself after living outside of the country for a long time. And somebody suggested that I do art on the computer, which I thought was the most ridiculous idea I had ever heard. And then a photographer friend of mine was using Photoshop, and I was looking over his shoulder, and I thought, now that's interesting. So I got a copy of Photoshop, and then forget about it. Everything was over except for that.
Yeah.
So the first job that I got was in a color lab, like factory retouching. But mm-hmm. I knew that was leading somewhere, and I realized that I wanted to do high-end retouching. So I kind of slaved away in that job for 2 years, like learning everything I could about not only Photoshop and retouching, but the printing process and profiles and all of the other stuff that goes along with it, which is really, really important for a retoucher to know.
Yeah. You know, my first professional commercial experience with Photoshop was also in a color lab, in a photo lab, a large regional photo lab. Mm-hmm. And when I started out there, this was in the mid 1990s. So the lab was still mainly an optical lab, printing from negatives and stuff like that. But we had film recorder devices. So what we would do is we would do our retouching, and then we would output the digital file to film, be that a negative or a 4x5 transparency. And then, you know, sometimes that was the deliverable. Sometimes we made further prints from those kind of digital negatives in the optical part of the lab. But, you know, yes. So sounds like we had a similar experience in the way we started out.
Yeah, and it has changed so much. I actually started in 2000. So, yeah, and when I came back, I lived in a third world country. And when I came back to the United States, I didn't even know how to turn on a computer. Literally, in 2000. I knew nothing about computers. And so...
Yeah.
Yeah, 15 years, 16 years later.
Well, when I was doing it, you know, that was, it was a service offered by this photo lab. And at that point in time, very few photographers themselves were doing Photoshop stuff. And when I started, it was Photoshop 3. So Photoshop had just gotten layers. It had just gotten layers.
Yeah, that was a good one to start with. I started on 3 also, but it wasn't the most up-to-date software. I got it, and then as soon as I started playing with it, I realized, oh, this is something it needs. So I went out and got myself a 5 was what Photoshop 5 was the one I started on. It was the newest that was out at that time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like everybody does, you know, you start with the software, you start doing stuff, and then, but you knew fairly early on from your experience in this color lab, it sounds like, that you were interested in doing the more high-end retouching.
It took me a while to even realize that that was a thing. Mm-hmm. But I mean, when I first just started using Photoshop, I didn't realize that that was a career direction at all, or that was a thing, you know. But once I got into the color lab, I, you know, was really fixated with Photoshop. One thing that I did that was really, really a good move on my part was I went to, actually, that's where I met you for the first time with giggle. Where was it? At the Photoshop World Convention, right?
Oh, right. I think that was in San Diego.
Was it? I keep thinking it was Los Angeles for some reason.
It was either that, or it was either L.A. or San Diego. But it was Southern California.
I think it was L.A. because it was near the Staples Center.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Exactly. You're right.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, that and anyway, so I went to that and I learned a lot. Taking those various different classes, and I was so into it. I mean, mm-hmm. I was a Photoshop nerd. Like, I just couldn't get enough of it.
Sure. We've all been Photoshop nerds at one point or another. And of course, we still are.
we still are. But that was a really fun time because I knew enough about Photoshop not to get lost in it, you know, mm-hmm. not to be overwhelmed anymore. But I needed to learn new tricks. And it once it was the kind of thing that it wasn't out there as easy to find it as it is now on the internet. So going to Photoshop World, you learned all these tips and tricks, so-called tricks, that you just couldn't find easily elsewhere. Now there's too much stuff out there because people go on, you know, everybody and their brother's a high-end Photoshop retouch teacher. Mm-hmm. But they're teaching poor technique, and that's the problem with people going out doing tutorials online, is to decipher between what's a high-end technique and what's a, you know, terrible technique. I was searching for a nice word. To
you're trying to be diplomatic.
For example, the last 3 to 5 years, all of a sudden, everybody's using frequency separation.
Yeah, I know. That's like the total buzzword you hear all the time.
And it's the most horrible technique, in my opinion, in the world. I mean, maybe somebody, if they do it just exactly right, can get away with it. But it creates fake-looking texture. It if they do it wrong, it's completely blurred. I have an example of it on my desktop. I will show you because I've been advertising for freelancers to come work here with me. Mm-hmm. And so I get a lot of applications with like just the craziest before and afters. And I said on my ad, no filters on the skin. The only way to do high-end skin is some healing and cloning and dodge and burn. Mm-hmm. Dodge and burn. No frequency separation, no filters, no blurring. But I know it takes longer, but we get paid by the hour here, you know?
Yeah, there you go. That's good. And so in your work that you do, you're working for... are you working directly with photographers who need you to do the retouching or with ad agencies, designers? What's the typical sort of client relationship?
So I work for photographers and I work for ad agencies. And I also work for directly for companies. Like I have a hair company that I work for, and one of the three owners of the hair company does all the photography for the company as well. And I work directly for him. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the company like Paul Mitchell is also one that I work for. So I work for actually the Paul Mitchell company. It's the art director within that company that calls me and gives me the job. Aquage and Biomega. I also work directly for that company and their art directors.
And so I imagine that in this business that the word of mouth is probably a lot of how you built your clientele initially.
Yes, absolutely. You know, cold calling people never works. Mm-hmm. Now, I mean, in the beginning, I tried a lot of that and, you know, I tried a lot of different things to market myself. But really, in the end, the only way that I've gotten clients is from word of mouth. I did get one big client who saw me speaking at the Photo Plus convention. So you can that's one way you can market yourself is you can teach it, which I get a lot of recognition because I teach workshops at the School of Visual Arts. And of course I wrote a book that got me some attention. And I speak every year at the Photo Plus convention. So that does give me a little notoriety as well. But other than that, it's mainly through just word of mouth and people suggesting me that have used me before.
Right. And so, you know, for, you know, when you first start out in Photoshop, of course, there's certain tools you gravitate to right away. And one of those, for better or for worse, a lot of times for worse, is the clone stamp tool. You know, people have a lot of fun with that right away. I know that I did when I was first starting out, adding multiple eyes to people and doing strange, surreal things.
Right. It's fun.
It is fun, but easy to do a lot of damage and make your picture look much worse than it ever started out as. So, yes. You know, in terms of, you know, kind of common things that you see that are, in terms of retouching, that are, kind of done, I don't know if I want to use the word wrong, but, you know, sloppily or, you know, common pitfalls that people fall into. Can you think of any that come to mind in terms of advice to pass on?
I can think of many, 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 but the first and the biggest one for me is, not knowing how to set your brush settings. Well, one thing I always say in my classes is that, you open up a brand new copy of Photoshop and you grab your brush tool and you just start painting, or you grab your clone stamp tool and you just start cloning. But yeah. The setting is going to be the Photoshop default setting, right? Mm-hmm. That's what it will be, because there's a million, literally probably a million settings, that ways that you can set your brush up to work and your clone stamp to work, right? So why would you just use the default setting? You don't even know what the default setting is, right? If the default brush was set up to a four-leaf clover brush, would you just leave it like that? Right.
No. Well, you'd certainly notice it right away.
You certainly would. So, one of the biggest parts of almost the first whole entire morning of one of my workshops is just talking about the brush tool, the brush panel, and how it works and what it does. Like, you know, you have opacity and you have flow. What's the difference? And what are the differences in the brush panel, the different check boxes that you can check, and what do they do? So I go into great detail about that in my workshops. So that's one of the first main things that I see, because people are struggling to do stuff that they're having to work harder to get something that they want, then they have to, because they have the wrong settings on their brush. Like dodge and burn, for example, you need to have a very delicate brush. And that doesn't mean just dropping your opacity way down. I don't use opacity, by the way. That would probably be what most people would think to do, is just drop your opacity way down low. But just doing that is not going to give you a good dodge and burn brush.
And so I'm guessing that the reason you're not using opacity is that you find it's easier to control with the stylus. Is that it?
No, that's not it at all. Opacity is just a matter of tone, and it also doesn't work well with the stylus. You're right. But that's not why, because first off, I keep the opacity all the way up at 100%, and I click on my airbrush tool, which automatically switches your function from opacity to flow. So I use flow to go up and down and I use flow, and then I take the flow from, you know, from 2% all the way to 100%, depending on what it is I'm doing.
So while we're on the subject of flow, because that question comes up a lot, let's clarify for people what flow is, because opacity, I think, is fairly easy for most people to understand. That's just sort of the level of translucency. Or how much you can see through the brush stroke or layer or whatever. I think most people get that. But flow kind of trips people up. How would you define what flow is?
Flow flow works more like an actual airbrush, right? Mm-hmm. So if you were painting with an airbrush, you've got an airbrush and you're painting. So the faster you go, the less paint is going to be able to go in that area. Or, you know, if you go faster, you're going to let down less paint than if you take with a slow hand. Right. And it works right. Exactly like that. You go faster in one area, there'll be less paint laid down. And if you slow your hand down, the paint's coming out at an even steady flow. Right. Exactly. Flow. So if you slow your hand down, so basically you could get a more transparent layer of paint. If you go fast and if you slow down, you can get a thicker paint all the way to black. If you keep going back and forth over the same area, you can go from, almost transparent to completely black and just without lifting up your pen from the tablet. Okay.
And so would you equate the going slower to a higher flow or a lower flow setup?
Well, no matter where you have your flow, that's going to be the case, faster or slower.
Yeah.
But when you take the flow down, it's like actually on the airbrush, on an actual physical airbrush, like lowering how much paint is actually coming out at any given time. If you have it all up the way up to 100, it's like going to shoot out maximum paint. But if you lower the flow down lower, then that then there's less paint that's being sprayed out. It works exactly like that.
Right, right.
And then when you can work with flow without having the airbrush on, but I always have the airbrush on. And the difference is that if you're painting on your tablet and then you just come to a complete stop, but you're still holding your stylus to the tablet, the flow will stop painting. If you just have flow on, it'll stop painting if you don't move your hand anymore. But if you have airbrush on and you stop and continue to hold your pen to the tablet, it will continue to paint.
Yeah, just like if you had, for those people who haven't used an airbrush, if you hold the plunger or the button down on a can of spray paint, it's just going to keep shooting paint out.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. You can think of it as it's basically the same thing as, you know, like a can of spray paint or an airbrush kind of work the same way.
And then just to clarify for people, what we're referring to is that when you have a brush tool active in Photoshop, in the options bar, right after the flow setting, there is a little airbrush option that you can enable that behavior. And so that's what Carrie has been referring to.
Yeah. I can point that out when we go to the desktop.
Yeah. Well, let's take a look at some of those before and after examples that you have set up that give us an idea of some of the work that you do.
Okay, so here's an example, just to show some examples of the kind of things that we are asked to do. This is kind of a file from quite some time ago, and it's pretty retouched in the end, but one of the things that they asked me to do here was they gave me this file and asked me to remove the rain.
So they were spritzing the model with water there to get that effect, I'm guessing.
Yeah, right, exactly. So she and as you can see, if I zoom in just a little bit, you can see that you can see all the little blue water raindrops being splattered on her. So my first reaction, and this was a long time ago, I think today I would probably just go, "Oh gosh." And not, you know, like, okay, that's work. But back then I thought, oh my God, how was I going to do it? Because this was quite some time ago. But so I just got started and took the rain off.
Huh.
Right. So. So
you're working on a duplicate layer, obviously, for that.
Yeah. As you can see over here, I have this all simplified down just showing before and afters and so on. But it was mainly color work. Let me just turn that on and off a couple of times. Mainly just color work and cloning and dodging and burning. And when I use my clone stamp tool, I don't just, this is a interesting FYI because I'm very particular about the clone stamp, the brush settings for brush and clone, etc. But as you'll notice, when I just hit my clone stamp tool, the mode up here was set to lighten. apparently from something that I was doing earlier this morning. Because when I use my clone stamp tool, most often I'm going to be using either the lighten blending mode or the darken blending mode. And those two blending modes are what I use when I do my skin cloning. So there's less chance of doing destructive things to my image. It just makes it easier to be less destructive, because clone stamping is destructive no matter what. Mm-hmm. But it's less troublesome if you use these two blending modes, I've found.
Yeah, no, those are definitely very handy.
Yes. And so once I took the rain off, they're like, okay, great. So now I want you to make make her hair dry.
Man, they just couldn't stop, huh?
No. I was like, what? But of course, nowadays, since that time, I've put hair from one shot onto another shot a million times. So they provided me with 5 or 6 other selects when her hair was dry earlier. And I just chose pieces from those shots and warped it onto her head too. And this was Photoshop back a ways. It was harder for me to get the hair on there because we didn't have the warp tool the way we have now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we had free transform, but not warp.
Hmm. Yeah. Warp is a very useful tool.
Oh yeah, I use it constantly, every day. Of course. So another example of interesting things that we get asked to do is too zoomed in there. Fix hairlines. A lot of times the girls are wearing wigs.
Yeah, why don't you zoom in a little bit closer so we can see that wig line there?
Yeah.
Because that's where all the action is. Oh yeah, obvious wig.
This one's really obvious, but they're not usually that obvious, but apparently they just figured, oh, let Carrie fix it. So, and they said they wanted to keep the dark roots. And so, and I did that by pulling different parts of hair and just masking it in. And I used a lot of high pass, which is a filter that helps to sharpen things and also allows you to pick up pieces of texture. I think I could show you quickly how you can pick up a piece of texture from one place and put it into another. If I just lasso that little area of hair right there,
and then
I'm just going to hold the command key down, or control if you're on a PC, and hit the J key, which will pop that up on a layer by itself over here, makes a new layer of it. And then I go to filter, other, high pass. And then probably about something between on a high resolution file, something between 8 and 9 is probably about right. Just click OK. And as you see it now, it looks funny. But what I do is I just set this to soft light, and then I just tap the V keys to get my move tool and drag the... Now you see that I have the actual texture of that hair, but on a transparent layer, so that I just have the texture.
Oh right, yeah, because the gray areas created by the high pass filter are being hidden by the soft light blend mode.
The soft light blend mode, exactly. It's just like high pass is basically a 50% gray layer. If you set a 50% gray layer to soft light, it will become invisible.
Right.
So basically, this is a 50% gray layer with that image information embedded into it, both the highs and the lows, the darks and the lights. So therefore the darks become visible and the lights become visible, therefore giving you a piece of texture that you can. So if I have a soft area in the hair and I need to add more texture in, I can get the transform tool there and just turn it. So I can add detail. You know, those Pantene ads or those Garnier Nutrice ads where they have the big long hair. No, you're never going to get a shot that has hair that is perfectly in detail all the way down. So this is how we do it.
Interesting.
We take detail from one area and put it into another area that needs detail. So you can do that with skin or a multitude of things.
Yeah.
Fabrics that are missing, if you had to overwork a fabric like where you were like removing a wrinkle and you end up getting it kind of smudgy, soft, you can take texture from another area of that garment and high pass that texture and put it onto the area that you smudged up.
Oh, excellent. Excellent. No, that's a great tip. You know what I love about this is that, you know, we all kind of, once we get proficient at Photoshop, we kind of work in our kind of our grooves or our tracks that we've chosen to work in. You know, like I do a lot of for want of a better word, fine art photography, and then also compositing where I'm doing, you know, intricate multiple image composites. Mm-hmm. So I know the use for a lot of these techniques as it pertains to the type of work that I do, but like that's a totally new use for the high pass filter that I really hadn't thought about because I don't do, you know, this sort of, you know, beauty or fashion retouching. So that's very cool.
Right. We use it a lot in retouching. I couldn't live without my high pass.
Excellent. All right. What else do we got in there? In your bag of tricks there.
My bag of tricks. Well, you were just talking about compositing. So let's look at a composite image. This was fun. Here was the original. And you'll see that this guy's face, this guy behind the candles, this girl's head, I believe, this little guy back here, all of them have been swapped out.
Oh, okay. Right. Yeah. And of course the candles are flaming quite a lot.
Oh, right. And yes. Good point.
I see. The guy is blowing the flames. The guy with the candle. I get it.
Right. I was at the actual photo shoot for this. I'm not always at the shoots myself, but I was at this one and, we shot, the flame blower guy, with everybody else gone from the table. And he was a flame blower and he was actually, we removed everybody from the set and all the, drapery. So we didn't catch the place on fire and he blew, he had, you know, gasoline in his mouth and he blew fire several times and we shot it. And then I took those pieces and, dropped them in, of course.
So let me ask you a question here. This is kind of my compositing artist diving in here for a question. But when you are on set like that and you know kind of what the concept for the shoot is going to be, are you ever asked for, you know, input on, well, hey, Carrie, you know, is there something we can do that's going to make your end result compositing easier or whatever, you know? So how often does your retouching artist's input get factored into the actual shoot?
A lot, actually. The photographer wanted me on this shoot so that I could tell him what I might need. We did a few shots of, some of these performers individually, and they had products in their hand and or jewelry on their fingers. One guy was holding like some sort of a martini type thing and he had rings on his fingers. So I had the photographer go in, go in and shoot the hand and the glass so that, and the jewelry, of course, on his fingers so that I could drop that in for a sharper piece.
Oh, I see.
Then if you shot him full body, then I wouldn't, you know, the hand and the jewelry wouldn't be as sharp as we wanted it. So we shot it closer so I could comp it in.
I see. Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah. So that's
what was this image for? Just out of curiosity.
It was an editorial for this girl had a cookbook, and there was an article in an Elle magazine about her, and it was shot at this club not too far from me here in the East Village. It was a super hot club at the time that had like a burlesque show that they did. And these were all the performers. It was in a really cool little old theater building over on Christie Street.
Yeah, no, it looks great. It's always great to work with performers, you know, because the costumes, and they're really good at getting into the whole scenario.
Exactly. They're all actors and actresses and performers. So yeah, it was a lot of fun.
Cool.
And so talking about skin. So basically, dodge and burn, clone stamp tool on light and darken, and the healing brush. I used to tell people not to use the healing brush, but it has gotten better in the last couple of years. So the last iteration or two of Photoshop, there's been kind of a discussion that it got bad again. Some people were complaining it wasn't working right and it was having some problems, but I think actually it seems to be fixed now. So I do use it, but I, you know, you have to use your eye and be careful if it's doing something funky to your image. I've seen people who do whole retouch and they just heal everything, and then afterwards it's just a smudgy mess. It's, you know.
Yeah. And the other thing that I see people doing a lot of times in, you know, in training situations where I'm doing workshops or even, you know, one-on-one training, is that somebody will do something with either the clone stamp tool or the healing brush or whatever, and it will result in something that they see is not good. You know, it's obviously a problem, but the mistake that they make is instead of just undoing it, they try to go over it again.
Right.
And fix the mistake, which usually makes it work. It's like, wait a minute, you just undo it. Just go back, get rid of it.
In my class, I'm always like, the people are sitting sort of sideways from their keyboard and their screen. And one hand is down in there. You have to retouch with both hands, shoulders square to your screen. One hand is on the keyboard and the other hand is holding your pen. Cause you know, constantly when I'm cloning, command Z, if it's no good, I can command Z in like less than 1 second and I'm, you know, at it again. So here's the before. And on this particular one, this is like a really crazy, I love this image, but this one was really crazy. She had black makeup on her, which was exaggerating the bumps and so on. So it was quite a difficult retouch. And I had to smudge up some stuff because there were areas that were just, I just had to put too much elbow grease into it to get it where I needed it. So I high pass some texture from place to place to get a more even texture. The cool thing about high passing skin texture, it's a lot of people just put noise in there if they have a soft spot, but noise looks digital. That's just it is digital. It's a computer generated texture. But if you use high pass to take a good skin texture and put it someplace where you need it, it's real organic texture.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I love
it. Well, and the other thing about adding digital noise, I mean, it has its place in some situations, but what I found is that you often have to, at a later stage, add the same level of noise to the entire image just so that everything has, you know, a consistent level.
Exactly, because if you go in and, you know, you zoom in, I always tell my students, there was one time I was over in the Flatiron District where the Mac store is. Mac Cosmetics, and I came around the corner. I was thinking to myself, I was in my head, and I came around this corner, and I didn't even realize where I was at. And I looked up, and there was a 10-foot tall face only retouch of mine hanging in the window, and my stomach went bloop, 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 because I thought, oh my God, I know they're going to make the stuff that big sometimes, and bigger, but to see it printed that big, I thought, oh gosh. So I like stood there for the longest looking for mistakes. And of course there were none. because I use the right techniques.
Right, right. Yeah, well, that's the thing. You know, when something is printed large, it will show any retouching boo-boos. That's a technical term, boo-boos.
Yeah, and that's why you didn't used to use the healing brush. And I am careful about it even now when I'm doing like a cosmetics job like that.
Yeah.
But because back then at the time that Mac was done, if I had been using the healing brush, which I wasn't at all, period, on that image, it would have been seen, because if you zoom in closely and you do the healing brush, you can see that at least it used to like make a little storm of pixels. It looked like you look at all the pixels and they have like a uniform sort of texture. And mm-hmm. like when you're really super zoomed in, but then you click with a clone stamp tool, it looks like a cyclone or a tornado, like hit right there and swirled up the pixels.
Yeah.
You could really see it, especially if things were blown up.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah. That's really the acid test, you know, to mix metaphors there. But yeah, when things are printed that large, boy, the retouching has to hold up. Or the compositing, you know, whatever it is you've done to it.
Exactly. Of course, anytime you're moving pixels around, you've got to double check and use the right techniques. Just to point out, I was talking about the brush, by the way. So here's my brush. And as you can see right here, I have airbrush on. For every tool, I have it turned on. Like if I go to the clone stamp tool, the airbrush is turned on. I'm using flow. Mm-hmm. All right. This is the eraser tool. They changed the little icon, so you can barely tell that that's an eraser tool if you ask me, but okay. right. So you can see, I'm using my keyboard to change my tools.
Even the history brush, you've got the, airbrush on.
Yeah. Okay. So just to talk about the different brushes that you might be using, I'll just give this one tip. I'm not going to go into my huge, long spiel about how to set up brushes, of course, here. But one very important thing, this is the brush tool. Normally, when you open up Photoshop for the first time, this little thing right here called Shape Dynamics is on. Mm-hmm. And it creates a very weird brush. And I'm not going to go through my demo, but just suffice to say, you should, you know, look into that. I go in and turn it off for every tool. It will be on for everything, for every single tool. Eraser, brush tool clone, any brush type tool. That Shape Dynamics will be on, and it creates a very weird brush. You may find that if your clone stamp tool will work so much better if you just turn that off.
Okay. Good to know.
Yeah, it's very good to know. So the only time I use this is when I'm making specialty brushes, which if I come up here and open up my brushes, here are my preset brushes that I've made for my work. Mm-hmm. Okay, like for example, if I grab, I think, this one. You'll go in and see this is a brush that I use to create hair strokes. You can see that Shape Dynamics is turned on, because in Shape Dynamics, you click on the word, you get the options for it. You can get a jitter, because if you look at the little preview, I don't know if you guys can see that here, but instead of having one smooth brush, it has like a jitter to it. And when I use this brush, it's for hair and especially for things like eyelashes. And I'm going to just swoosh this out. I have two monitors here. I keep my panels on one monitor and just put that back, because I need to have that brush panel open at all times to see what brush, because it has that little preview, so I can see what brush I have real quick just by glancing. So do I need to change my brush? Oh yeah, I got an eyelash brush and I want to dodge and burn, so I need to change it. Right. Mm-hmm. So these eyelashes were created right here. I drew the eyelashes with an eyelash brush with the shape.
Wow, they look incredibly convincing.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. mean, everything looks incredibly convincing because, you know, on that picture there, there's just so much, you know, really kind of tactile, you know, visible, discernible skin texture there. And I'm sure a lot of that's coming from, you know, also the makeup that's on her as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah, very cool.
Thank you. Okay, so shall we dissect this?
Yeah, let's finish off by having a little deconstruction of that image.
I think it's really a good learning tool to just deconstruct someone's actual file. I mean, to be honest, really, that's how I learned most of my stuff. Most of what I know was by working in an actual high-end studio and looking at other, you know, like looking through and thumbing through, so to speak, another retoucher's layers.
Yeah.
To see how did they do it. So I have a Facebook retouchers group that I admin together with the creator of the group. So periodically I leave comments and help with critique and stuff there. So this was a photographer who gave his raw files for people to play with, and somebody had done something to it, and we got in a discussion about it. So I finally decided I was grab this image and do it as just a learning tool. So this wasn't a real job. So that's why I have it basically layered up so that we could, because typically I would merge some of this stuff, but I'll just start from the beginning. So normally I would not have the raw conversion underneath, mm-hmm. but I just have it here just so you can see. This would be a Photoshop raw conversion if I just didn't set any of the settings. I didn't change anything. I just accepted the default settings in Photoshop raw. Okay.
Is it possible to zoom up maybe one level on that just to sort of see?
Yeah.
Yeah, there we go. That way we can see. Because I know you're probably have done lots of great jobs smoothing out the skin on this one.
Yeah, there's some intricate work on this one. So this was, and this is, so far we're talking about color here, because the first thing that I did was, so this was if I just accepted Photoshop's decision for my raw conversion color, I would I would start from that. But instead, I tweaked the color in raw, and this was how I set up my color for my beginning layer, my background, basically. I did two conversions because I did one for the skin tone, and I did another one to pull this hair out because the conversion for the skin was losing the hair. So I did a second conversion and blended them together so that the hair popped out a little better. You can see that.
Yeah.
Okay, so then I started with this color instead because I wanted to kind of go for Ice Queen here.
Right.
So then the next layer is my retouching. I'm gonna pop in one more so we can just look at the face.
Yeah.
This layer would be healing and cloning only. Right. So it would be healing and cloning only, just the more egregious spots. Like the places that are too light to be able to dodge and burn, or the areas that are too dark to dodge and burn. Okay, so then I got to there. I'm not sure what this. There was a little. If I zoom at the end, you can see this better. There was a soft spot right here, so I high passed some texture into it.
Oh, okay. All right. I see. Okay.
And we can look at that at the end so you can kind of see the difference, but that's just where it is in the layers stack. And this is a color blend of some sort. We'll look at that later. And then the lashes, I drew the lashes in. I probably did that last, but that just happened to be where it's at. Right?
Wow. Those are amazingly convincing eyelashes.
Thank you. I have practiced.
Yeah, sure. Practice does make better, and sometimes it's perfect.
Yeah, you absolutely have to. This is something that you don't learn to do in a weekend. Okay, so this is, I'll just turn all of them on and off at the same time. This is my dodge and burn. The lips, I'll just show you the, that's just a, basically it's a dodge layer, but I just enhanced the shine on her lips, just a tiny tweak right there.
And let me just clarify for people who may be listening to the audio version here that that when Carrie is saying a dodge and burn layer, she's not actually referring to the dodge and burn tools. She is using curves adjustment layers with layer masks to achieve the lightening and or darkening effect that that she's referring to as dodge and burn.
Exactly. When I say dodge and burn, there are actual three dodge and burn techniques that I know of that are used in high-end retouching. In a high-end studio, if working at a high-end retouching studio here in New York City, you would be either dodging and burning. Basically, we call it that, although I use curves. And one of the layers, one is to lighten and one is to darken. So the lighten layer, of course, is dodging. This comes from the analog photography times when they would actually dodge and burn the light by, you know, that technique I'm not going to go into, but it's right, from right, the, yeah. It's the term that they used to either let light hit or let light not hit the image when they were processing it. So yeah, and then also there's the 50% gray layer that you can paint on with white and black, and that's also considered dodging and burning because you're darkening some areas and you're lightening some other areas. Okay, so I'm going to just turn on all my dodge and burn layers together so you can see what happens.
Hmm. Wow, that's significant.
Right. So I'll turn them all off. Okay, so this is just curves. So this is totally non-destructive. All this work was just done with curves.
And layer masks.
With layer masks. And I'll just go through these one at a time. I'll do the darken layer. It's at the very bottom, but I'll turn that one on last. So, because usually what I'll do is I'll do my first light layer. And you can see here's the curve. This is what the curve looks like. I just lightened. By the way, yours, if you do it with an RGB image, it will look like that.
Right.
Reason being that I learned retouching by working CMYK in CMYK, and a CMYK curve is upside down from an RGB curve.
Right. And so you have your curve options set to
exactly
show pigment rather than light.
Exactly. That's exactly yeah. Right. And where you do that is right here. Curve display options.
Right.
So you can change it right there. So this is the curve. I just lighten it a very tiny bit because you don't want to do your dodge and burn in one single layer. You know, if I were to pull that curve like really, really far, it will begin to give me colored discoloration. Okay. Mm-hmm. So I'll turn on the first one. There was one. Then I did another one. Same thing, same curve. I actually have an action set up so that I hit my F1 key, just totally makes a layer like this, fills it, the mask with black so that the effect is not showing, and names the layer. So just in 1 second by hitting the F1 key, I can get one of these dodge layers. Obviously, I use a gazillion of them a day. Yeah. And then here's the next one. And then as you see, like once I do my dodging, you can see there's a couple of little spots in here that are too light. So I want to blend the tones. So then I did my darken layer.
Huh. Amazing. Yeah, you know, a lot of people, I'm sure when they think of retouching, initially they think of things like the, you know, the clone stamp, the healing brush, spot healing brush, you know, those sorts of quote-unquote retouch tools. But so much of, you know, beauty and fashion glamour retouching is accomplished by adjustment layers and masks.
Absolutely. The more you can rely on the adjustment layers, the better, because yeah. Those are the non-destructive things that can be adjusted as well. Mm-hmm. So if, as you see, this is a curve that has a mask attached to it. So if I hold the option key down, I can turn on the mask so I can see what it looks like. So that's what this Dodge mask looks like, this curved mask looks
right,
like.
Right, right.
And then...
Yeah, those masks look cool just on their own.
Yeah, they can be pretty weird looking sometimes. yeah, so this, and that's another one. So basically, you get a lot of bang for your buck there. And so I only, in this particular, from there to there, is one dark layer and three lightened layers.
Uh-huh.
To pretty much finish it off. And she's got, and I'm keeping texture, reality, you know, looks real.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then I had a little thing to pop the gold of her nose ring and her earring.
Uh-huh.
And then on top is my color corrections. And this is before color and after. Let me, so you can see yours. So when you look at the before, you can notice that really what you're attracted to is the hand because it's so light.
Mm-hmm.
Right. It's a big distraction because it's so much wider and lighter than the face. So yeah. I swapped that around so that the lightness of the face is more and then darken the hand down a bit.
Right. Yeah.
And took some of that heat out of her.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then at the very top, I had I added a grain layer, which is 50% gray layer with noise we were talking about earlier. And I put a little noise on it and then put a little slight blur on the noise. That's just your generic grain 101.
Right, because you know, we mentioned earlier that when you add digital noise, it tends to look very digital, and part of the reason it looks quote unquote digital is that it's this very hard edge defined noise pattern, and by softening it down ever so slightly with a very faint blur, you can mask that a bit.
Right, and it looks a little bit more like actual film grain, which is what you want. I like. Not every image, but I like some of these images. There's been a few that came out in the last year. I saw some Vogue ads. Was it Dior ads that was heavy on the grain? And I thought it looked really nice on purpose.
So they were using grain more as a creative look.
Yeah, they were going leaning heavy on the grain on purpose. I thought it looked really nice. I mean, it's not something you want to do for every single image. And kind of an interesting thing is that at the top here, I have like a visualization layer. It does help me. If you look at her chest, for example, it really brings up the little, it's like if you're unable to see very well and you need to exaggerate the dark stuff that you need to dodge away, you can put a visualization layer at the top just to help you see.
And so that visualization layer, just to clarify for people who might be listening, it's a black and white adjustment layer, and you are adjusting the sliders to accentuate any
just drag the
irregularities
red down.
In the skin.
There are different ways of doing that black and white one, because some people say that this is not the best way. I mean, I don't usually use a Vig very often, very rarely, because I mean, I've just trained myself to be able to see. And on top of it, you have to be a little careful with a Vig. You might over retouch because you see too much.
And so how would you then use that layer? It's primarily for visualization. So you use it to point out, oh, I need to go do a little bit more work in that area. Is that how you're using it?
Right. It's just to see, because it intensifies those dark patchy areas in her chest that makes it easier for you to see, so you know where you need to dodge a little further.
Right.
Also, sometimes I'll just put a curve, which is also pretty good. Just set a curve and
right. Oh, I see. Just kind of,
and just leave it dark up there. And that way that accentuates those areas too. And it's maybe not quite as drastic as that.
Very, very cool.
Black and white. Yeah.
Yeah, no, very cool.
Yeah, this is just a simple one. I figured this is not a, like a finished beauty image, but I think good for first round.
Yeah, no, it's cool. No, a lot of really interesting techniques there, and happy as a fan of adjustment layers and layer masks, I'm happy to see lots of those there.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah,
now,
yeah.
Like I said, this is a simple one. When we get into other images, I have many, 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 many layers.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a big fan of using groups to keep your layer stack in good, clean condition.
Yeah, no, those are really nice, because when you have a complex retouching job or compositing job, your layers can multiply very quickly, and having them in groups definitely helps kind of manage them and corral them.
Bizarre that I'm so persnickety about that. Now, if you were to see my bedroom right now, it's a mess, but my layer, my go into any of my Photoshop files and everything will be pristinely stacked.
Yeah. No, I know what you mean. I have the same challenge with my office sometimes.
You're right. Yeah. Glad you guys can't see my desktop right now.
Well, that was very cool, Carrie. Thank you for that walkthrough and deconstruction of that file. I always find it, as you mentioned earlier, I think it's really useful to take a stroll through other people's work and see how they did all of their work and made the magic happen.
Yeah, I think it's always fascinating. I still like to look through other people's Photoshop files.
So you have, I think you mentioned earlier, you have a workshop coming up in the near future in New York City?
Yes, I have one in April at the School of Visual Arts. I don't actually know the dates right now, right offhand, but you can go to SVA's website and go to Continuing Education and just look up my last name. Just look up the teacher's name. There's a form there you can put in BEENE, my last name, Bean, and it will take you to my class. It's in April. It's a 2-day weekend workshop, intensive. You need to have
Intensive on this sort of work we've been seeing here.
Yeah, the one that's coming up is the second of two. You do not have to have gone to the first one. The first one is basically a beauty. But the second one next in April is beauty, but it's like you're going to do an entire beauty spread with the beauty, which is the headshot of the girl, a lifestyle, which is the full body of the girl, and a product, and sew them all together into a composite image.
Cool. That sounds great.
Yeah, it's pretty intense.
I'll find out what the link is, and I'll put a link to that in the show notes.
Oh, great. Thanks.
And then you also have a book called Real Retouching, A Professional Step-by-Step Guide, and I'll put a link to that in the show notes as well.
Fabulous.
What's your website where people can find out more about you and see more examples of your work?
The website is carrienyc.com. Real simple.
Okay, excellent. Well, we'll have a link there as well. So, cool. Excellent stuff. And I certainly picked up some stuff here. I mean, I knew I would, because even though I know Photoshop fairly well, I do not do this sort of work on a regular basis. And whenever you talk to somebody who does this sort of work day in, day out, you know, they've got all the cool techniques and tricks that they've learned through, you know, years of doing it, as you have.
Yeah, 15 years of retouching. I can't believe it.
Wow. Well, thank you so much for coming on and sharing some of that with us.
Absolutely. That was a lot of fun.
Cool. And thank you out there in internet land for tuning in and watching The Fix. Remember, you can always subscribe to the audio version on iTunes, or you can go to the website thisweekinphoto.com/thefix to check out the video version. And there's also an audio version you can download there as well. Obviously, for certain versions of the podcast, the video version is good to see, because there's lots of cool visuals on screen. Anyway, we will see you next week on another episode of The Fix. I'm Sean Duggan. Thanks for watching.